KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Given what you've said about Gaza, did the U.S. send troops to help secure the security vacuum?
As far as Gaza is concerned, we'll do what is necessary. If it's necessary, we'll do that.
In a stunning announcement, President Trump has called for the United States to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population in order to turn Gaza into the, quote, Riviera of the Middle East. Trump's call for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza came while meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. He was invited there despite an arrest warrant for him issued by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity. We'll get the latest. Then we look at the fight against Trump's escalating attacks on the trans community.
Since January 20th, it has been one attack after another from the Trump administration on transgender people across all facets of life. Yesterday, the ACLU and Lambda Legal took action, filing a lawsuit challenging the president's executive order seeking to ban health care nationwide for trans people under 19. We are fighting back with everything we have.
We'll speak to Chase Strangio of the ACLU, which is suing the Trump administration. And we'll talk to a New York doctor who says he's willing to go to jail to continue providing health care to transgender youth. And we'll speak to the former top lawyer at the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She was fired last week as part of Trump's purge of federal workers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has called for the ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strip's more than 2 million Palestinians and their permanent displacement to Jordan, Egypt, or other countries, and for the United States to take ownership of Gaza. Trump's extraordinary comments came as he welcomed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House to discuss plans for Gaza following Israel's 15-month war on the territory, which international law experts have said amounts to genocide.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area.
Trump said he'd lifted a pause on the supply of U.S.-made 2,000-pound bombs to Israel imposed under the Biden administration. And Trump refused to rule out sending U.S. troops to Gaza.
I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy, but the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad. This could be so magnificent.
Ahead of his White House meeting, Prime Minister Netanyahu met with U.S. evangelical leaders, including former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, Trump's nominee for U.S. ambassador to Israel. At least one Democratic senator, Pennsylvania's John Fetterman, said Tuesday he'll support a potential U.S. occupation of the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, human rights groups have condemned the U.S. for failing to serve an arrest warrant for Prime Minister Netanyahu issued by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has rejected Trump's proposal to take over the Gaza Strip, calling the proposal a serious violation of international law and peace and stability in the region, unquote. Hamas condemned Trump's ideas as a recipe for creating chaos and tension, unquote. The leaders of Egypt and Jordan flatly rejected the idea, as did Saudi Arabia, which said it would not establish ties to Israel without the creation of a Palestinian state. The vast majority of Gaza's residents have also rejected the plan. This is Rafida Akhil, a displaced Palestinian in Khan Yunis.
We completely refuse to be displaced from Palestine. Palestine is our land, our country, the land of our ancestors, and the land of our children, God willing. We reject this idea. I call on any Arab or foreign country to receive any Palestinian citizen. This is our land, and we are staying here, and we will remain here, God willing.
In more news from Gaza, the beloved poet, academic, and activist Rafat Al-Arir has finally been laid to rest more than a year after he was killed in an Israeli strike, along with his sister, brother, and four nephews. His family recovered their remains after a neighbor buried them in a yard at the site of the Israeli attack. Al-Arir was buried in a cemetery in Gaza City's Sujayir neighborhood, where Al-Arir was born. President Trump has ordered nearly the entire staff of the U.S. Agency for International Development to be placed on administrative leave beginning Friday, and ordered thousands of personnel working overseas to return to the U.S. The order impacts some 10,000 USAID workers around the world. Democratic lawmakers have called it an illegal move to shutter an aid agency that was created through an act of Congress. Meanwhile, an executive order signed by President Trump Tuesday orders the U.S. to withdraw from the United Nations Human Rights Council and end U.S. support for UNRWA, the U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Trump also ordered a review of the U.N.'s cultural agency, UNESCO. This follows Trump's January 24th decision to halt billions of dollars of U.N. funding pending a 90-day review. Among the many casualties is the Sexual Reproductive Health Agency, the UN Population Fund. P.O. Smith is the agency's Asia-Pacific director.
I'm deeply concerned that millions of women and girls now face life-threatening risks due to the lack of access to UNFPA's crucial services across Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. Take the example of Afghanistan. Between 2025 and 2028, we estimate that the absence of U.S. support will result in 1,200 additional maternal deaths and 109,000 additional unintended pregnancies.
The CIA has offered its employees 8 months' salary and benefits in exchange for early retirement, becoming the first U.S. intelligence agency to offer buyouts to the entire staff. This comes after the White House said at least 20,000 civilian U.S. government workers, or about 1% of the federal workforce, have accepted a buyout offer advanced by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. On Monday, unions representing civilian government workers sued the U.S. Treasury and Secretary Scott Bessent, alleging the department illegally granted Elon Musk and his DOGE associates access to the personal information of millions of people across the U.S., including Social Security numbers, tax returns, home addresses, phone numbers, bank account information, and more. Separately, Wired magazine reported federal workers are seeking a temporary restraining order as part of a class action lawsuit accusing a group of Elon Musk's young associates of operating an illegally connected server from the fifth floor of the U.S. Office of Personnel Management's headquarters in Washington, D.C. The motion contends Musk's moves not only violate federal law, but are potentially exposing vast amounts of government workers' personal information to hostile foreign adversaries through unencrypted email. On Tuesday, Democratic lawmakers joined hundreds of protesters outside the Treasury Department to denounce Elon Musk's what they called hostile takeover of the federal civilian bureaucracy. The lawmakers were barred from entering the Treasury building. This is Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley.
There's a sign back there that says DOGE actually means dangerous oligarchs grab everything. Yeah. Well, ain't that the truth? I am so tired of these billionaire boys and their grubby little hands grabbing at everything. Hands off our bodies, hands off our data, hands off our tax refunds, hands off our Social Security checks, hands off our Constitution, hands off our democracy, hands off!
In Ukraine, Ukraine, a Russian strike on the town of Izium Tuesday killed 5 civilians, including a pregnant teenager. At least 55 others were wounded in the attack, which partially destroyed Izium City Council building. Elsewhere, Russian shelling killed 2 civilians in southern Ukraine, and a Ukrainian drone attack set a Russian oil depot near the Black Sea on fire. On Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's open to having U.S. companies invest in Ukraine's rare earth metals industry, after President Trump said military aid should be tied to securing the rights of minerals needed for U.S. high-tech and weapons industries. Trump made the remarks Monday.
We're telling Ukraine they have very valuable rare earth. We want what we put up to go in terms of a guarantee. We want a guarantee. We're handing a money hand over fist.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz sharply criticized Trump's proposed quid pro quo with Zelensky as, quote, very selfish, very self-centered, unquote. The Senate's approved Pam Bondi to become U.S. Attorney General, handing control of the Justice Department to a Trump loyalist who's refused to say whether Trump definitively lost the 2020 election. Democrats fear Bondi will weaponize the Justice Department to seek vengeance against Trump's political foes. Bondi's confirmation comes after Trump purged dozens of career prosecutors and FBI agents who worked on 2 criminal cases against Trump. The mishandling of classified documents by Trump and his associates at Mar-a-Lago and the January 6th Capitol insurrection. On Tuesday, 2 separate groups of FBI agents filed lawsuits seeking to block the public release of the names of thousands of Justice Department workers who worked on those criminal investigations. In related news, a historic black church in Washington, D.C. that was vandalized in December of 2020 by members of the Proud Boys has been granted control over the far-right group's trademark name. The landmark ruling means the Black Metropolitan AME Church is entitled to proceeds from sales of the Proud Boys merchandise and membership dues. The group would also have to get permission from the church and federal court to sell anything with its name and insignia. The victory comes after the Proud Boys failed to pay nearly $3 million in punitive damages to the church for burning its Black Lives Matter sign after attending a Trump rally. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit challenging Trump's executive order banning medical care for transgender people under the age of 19. The order directs federal agencies to withhold funds from medical providers and institutions that offer life-saving, gender-affirming medical treatments. Several hospitals nationwide have already suspended the care. We'll have more on this story after headlines with ACLU's Chase Strangio and a New York doctor who says he's willing to go to jail to continue providing health care to transgender youth. The Senate Finance Committee has advanced Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, a sprawling federal bureaucracy with 80,000 workers and a $1.6 trillion budget. Senators voted 14-13 along party lines to recommend RFK Jr.'s confirmation in the full Senate, despite his long history of promoting public health conspiracy theories and anti-vaccine disinformation. Among Republicans voting yes was Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, a medical doctor who spent decades promoting vaccinations for children. Meanwhile, the Senate Intelligence Committee has advanced the nomination of Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence on a party-line vote of 9-8, with all the committee's Republicans in support. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, UN officials report hundreds of women were raped and burned to death as M23 seized Goma, triggering chaos in the eastern city. The gruesome attacks occurred during a jailbreak in which thousands of men were able to escape the prison while the women's wing was set on fire. Restrictions imposed on M23 forces have blocked UN peacekeepers from reaching the prison to investigate. And in the Philippines, Vice President Sara Duterte has been impeached by House lawmakers and faces what could be removal from office later this year. Duterte has been accused of corruption and misusing millions of dollars in public funds and faced widespread backlash after she threatened to have Filipino President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., his wife, and the Filipino House Speaker assassinated. The Philippine Senate will hold its impeachment trial against Sara Duterte when Congress reconvenes in June. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now's Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
In a stunning announcement, President Trump has called for the United States to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population in order to turn Gaza into what he called the, quote, Riviera of the Middle East. Trump's plan for ethnic cleansing has been widely condemned across the globe. Trump outlined his plan Tuesday in a joint news conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. In November, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu for committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. This is part of what Trump said on Tuesday.
The only reason the Palestinians want to go back to Gaza is they have no alternative. It's right now a demolition site. This is just a demolition site. Virtually every building is down. They're living under fallen concrete that's very dangerous and very precarious. They instead can occupy all of a beautiful area with homes and safety, and they can live out their lives in peace and harmony instead of having to go back and do it again. The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area. Do a real job, do something different. Just can't go back. If you go back, it's going to end up the same way it has for 100 years.
Trump went on to describe his vision of a U.S.-controlled Gaza that had been cleared of Palestinians.
We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal. And I don't want to be cute, I don't want to be a wise guy, but the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad, this could be so magnificent.
During his White House press conference, Trump was questioned about the role of the U.S. military in his plan to take control of Gaza and force out the Palestinian population.
Given what you've said about Gaza, did the U.S. send troops to help secure the security vacuum?
As far as Gaza is concerned, we'll do what is necessary. If it's necessary, we'll do that. We're going to take over that piece. We're going to develop it, create thousands and thousands of jobs, and it'll be something that the entire Middle East can be very proud of.
Trump's plan quickly drew condemnation at home and abroad. Saudi Arabia reiterated it will not establish ties with Israel without the creation of a Palestinian state. Arab leaders have already refused calls to take in Palestinians forcibly removed from Gaza. Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory, has said Trump's plan is unlawful, immoral, and completely irresponsible. She said, quote, it's incitement to commit forced displacement, which is an international crime, unquote. In Gaza, Palestinians also rejected Trump's plan. This is Yasser Safi speaking in Khan Yunis.
We got out of wreckage, destruction, and a war of attrition, a genocide in which we don't know when death will come to us from all directions. But we stayed, held on, and remained until the last breath. This president, who is called Donald Trump, comes to us with a new method to displace us from our country where we are rooted. This is our land. We will not get out of it. If you refuse that there would be rebuilding, life, or future, and you come up with another idea in which Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, or others call for us to get displaced. This is absolutely refused. Even if you fight us with our food or our rebuilding, and you can see this wreckage here, here we set up a tent on the rubble.
We're joined now by two guests. Daniel Levy is president of the U.S. Middle East Project, a former Israeli peace negotiator under two Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. He's joining us from London. And in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Youssef Munayir. He is a Palestinian-American analyst, the head of the Palestine-Israel program at Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Youssef, we're beginning with you. Your response to President Trump's proposal for the U.S. to occupy, rather, to own Gaza.
Right. Thank you, Amy. Well, look, we saw yesterday a convicted felon in the White House meeting with a indicted war criminal in Benjamin Netanyahu. And I don't think we should be surprised that the outcome is yet another conspiracy to commit further crimes, in this case with the forced displacement, ethnic cleansing, and now apparently an American project of attempting to overtake and annex the Gaza Strip. It's important, too, to keep in mind that this is just the latest in a series of territories that are not American that this president seems to want to take over after Greenland and the Panama Canal and Canada and whatever else. What we are witnessing here is not diplomacy, but criminality by a couple of mafiosos who think this is how you do business. They have a complete disregard for law. They have a complete disregard for rights, and their vision for the world is one in which power is all that matters, and they seek to use the power they have to take more of what belongs to other people. This is a world of chaos and danger, which we learned the very steep price and consequences of in the previous century. And I can guarantee you that Palestinians will be the first to reject this vision for the world, along with much of the region and the international community as well.
Yeah, and Yusuf, about the rest of the region, clearly the masses of the people in many of the countries of the Middle East support the Palestinians, but the governments of many of these states have, to say the least, been equivocal or AWOL in terms of confronting Israel. What's your sense of the impact that this kind of announcement, this kind of policy by the United States might have on the governments of the region?
I think one thing we have to remember is from the perspective of the region, whether it is at the level of the public or at the level of governments, one thing that is clear to everybody is that nothing has been more destabilizing for the region over the last eight decades than the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by Israel. And nobody is at any level is going to sign up for a continuation of that. It's not just ethically and morally repugnant. It's also destabilizing and contrary to the national interests of everyone in the region. So I don't think it's something that anyone is going to voluntarily cooperate with. And mind you, this is a region that has been suffering from what the Israelis have done to the Palestinians and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians for a very long time, much longer than any presidential term and much longer than Donald Trump will be around. And they're going to weigh the consequences of such a proposal through the lens of a much longer term than just the few years that Donald Trump is going to be with us.
And Daniel Levy, your response to this extraordinary announcement of Donald Trump that the United States intends to own Gaza?
I look at that, and I looked at the images of that sickening press conference, and you could not draw a starker contrast than the one between the words of those two leaders, one, as Yusuf said, a felon, another with an arrest warrant for war crimes. Surprise, surprise, two settler colonial leaders planning the renewed attempt at ethnically cleansing an indigenous population. But you could not draw a sharper contrast between those words and the realities in Gaza of the resilience of the Palestinian people, which we have all been witness to amidst all the devastation and killing. Those scenes, is even aware that hundreds of thousands of people have just picked up whatever of their belongings they have and gone back to reconstruct lives in that rubble? So I'm tempted to say, one, that you know, maybe we should take some solace from this being so not serious, I would argue, so not implementable a plan. I actually worried that they would come out with something yesterday that could gain traction, could have legs. I don't think that applies to this plan. I don't see how they do it with the realities of Palestinians, with the realities in the region. I'm sure they have whiplash in the DOD, in the US military. Wait, sir, are we supposed to be planning for the invasion of Greenland, the Panama Canal, or Gaza? And even Peter Hezget's DOD is going to struggle with all of that. And therefore, I look at this and I say, yes, dangerous. Dangerous because of the fertile environment on which it falls inside Israel, a country that, if you see the statements of political leaders, including from the so-called opposition, giddy with excitement, a country that has undertaken these genocidal actions, that does actually have those plans and those intentions to make this real. But perhaps Israel's greatest Achilles heel would be if it actually falls for the idea that America is all powerful. And in a day when it's very hard to take a deep breath and count to 10, I would urge people to remind themselves of all those other great plans to shape and fashion and design the Middle East region, West Asia, in America's image. And how did those end up? And what did that do for America? Because this does nothing to serve American interests whatsoever.
I want to remind people what Trump's son-in-law, former advisor Jared Kushner, said about Gaza containing very valuable waterfront property last year.
In Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up, livelihoods.
So that was Jared Kushner last year. Daniel Levy, I wanted to ask you, if, in fact, Trump has put forward several times that Jordan, that Egypt should take the entire Palestinian population, and he hasn't gotten much traction. So he takes it a step further, and he says not only should they be displaced, but we will occupy or we will own Gaza. And so then it looks like he's compromising. Well, maybe the U.S. troops don't move in, but we won't move in if you, Egypt, if you, Saudi Arabia, and you, Jordan, take the Palestinian population. Is this part of a strategy? He did not say this off the cuff. I want to be very clear about this. For people listening on the radio, in fact, he is looking down, reading his notes.
Yes.
And when Netanyahu responds, he sounds like he's off the cuff saying, you know, this is Trump. But he is clearly reading his response. And does this then satisfy the far right in Israel, if Netanyahu isn't that, to keep his coalition together? Because then there's something that would allow them to move into the second phase of the ceasefire.
Very important. Indeed, much of the Israeli media is running with the story that these plans were presented by Netanyahu, by his right-hand henchman, Minister Ron Dermer, who used to be ambassador in the U.S. and American Miami Republican earlier in life, that they cooked this up. And I think Netanyahu comes away with a victory image in Washington, D.C., the very victory image that he has been denied in Palestine, in Gaza, as we see that this idea of a total victory, the emaciation, destruction of Hamas, not happening. The Palestinians giving up, not happening. So he has a win in Washington. The slight problem for Israel is that Israel is geographically not the 51st state of the USA. So when he goes home to a region that has been watching on its social media feeds the self-incriminating postings of Israelis conducting these atrocities. And it's not a region that Israel is making itself any more amenable to being able to absorb, to live with. Now, Netanyahu, I think, comes out of this, yes, feeling politically strengthened. His coalition allies who have been wavering because they don't want, neither did Netanyahu, by the way, they don't want this Gaza ceasefire deal, which I think has now been endangered to the point of very likely its collapse after or perhaps even during phase one being guaranteed. But those coalition allies have come around and said, now we see a way to continuing to support you. This is great. Netanyahu may feel empowered to go further, to even call an early election. He hasn't got what he wanted on Iran, and normalization with Saudi Arabia seems to have really taken a back burner role here. But the idea that this can be actualized, and I think here Netanyahu has a bit of a dilemma in a way, because he will now think, maybe I have to make good on this. Now, we hear this narrative from the administration. Yeah, it's the humane. They actually said this. It's the humane thing to do, because who could live in those circumstances? The humane thing to do would not have been to send those bombs. And let's not pretend that Biden didn't send the bombs. This is the legacy of the genocidal Biden administration. The humane thing to do would have been not to have sent those bombs, to have prevented this long ago. And you know what? If you really are talking about the well-being of the Palestinians, well, there is an area adjacent to Gaza where many in Gaza, many Palestinians come from originally, in the south of Israel, in the Negev, in the Nakab, an area that they could go back and forth, work in Gaza. So this is not about those things. And I would just point out the degree of concern in the region when the Saudis take to their own social media in the middle of the night to reject this. And what you might see, if it were actually implemented, which I don't think it will be, I really don't, is Jordan and Egypt becoming frontline resistance states, something they haven't been until now. So the unintended consequences rule really plays out here. And I think the other headline is, I just want to say, what do allies make of an America apparently so incapable of working out priorities? What are you thinking now if you're in Europe dealing with Ukraine? And indeed, what are you thinking if you're on the other side of that ledger and you watch America floundering around with madcap schemes?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Yusuf, the other announcements of the Trump administration related to the Middle East that occurred on Tuesday, the halt of funding for the Palestinian, extending the halt of funding for the Palestinian Relief Agency, UNRWA, the Trump's authorization of the transfer of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel, and his executive order reimposing maximum pressure on Iran.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, again, this is not particularly surprising. Trump is searching for ways to appear more pro-Israel than his predecessor, which is, as Daniel noted, supported the Israeli military through a horrific genocide for 15 months, one that is in many ways still ongoing and expanding to other parts of Palestine as we speak. And so these kinds of steps that he is taking is very much being done to further that image that somehow Joe Biden was not pro-Israel enough, and that you know, he is even more supportive of what Israel is doing. I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind in the background of this conversation is that after Elon Musk, the second biggest contributor to Donald Trump's reelection campaign was Miriam Adelson, who gave $100 million. To Donald Trump's reelection effort. And this is also one of the biggest supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu. And I believe she was in attendance yesterday at all of the events between the two criminals who were gathering at the White House.
Well, Yusuf Munayyer, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American analyst, head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C., and Daniel Levy, former Israeli peace negotiator, president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Coming up, we look at the fight against Trump's escalating attacks on the trans community. With ACLU attorney Chase Strangio, the ACLU is suing the Trump administration. And we'll speak to a New York doctor who says he'll continue providing health care to transgender youth. Then a lawyer with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, was fired last week by the Trump administration. Stay with us.
Hey, Roman numeral 7, babe, drop it like it's hot. If this world was mine, I'd take your dreams and make them multiply. If this world was mine, I'd take your enemies in front of God. Introduce them to that light, hit them strictly with that fire. Fa, 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 fa.
Hey, Roman numeral 7, babe, drop it like it's hot. If this world was mine, I'd take your dreams and make them multiply. If this world was mine, I'd take your enemies in front of God. Introduce them to that light, hit them strictly with that fire. This a vibe, do your dance, let them watch. She a fan, he a flop, they just wanna kumbaya, nah.
This world, concrete flowers grow. Heartache, she only do what she know. We can skid a poppin' on the low. Better days coming for sure.
This world,
if it was up to me, I wouldn't give it nobody no sympathy. I'll take away the pain, I'll give you everything.
Luther by the Grammy Award-winning Kendrick Lamar and SZA. Happy birthday, Arthur. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Since taking office, President Trump signed a slew of executive orders attacking transgender people and their rights. Today, we look at a key order that's being challenged by doctors, lawyers, and trans activists and their allies. Last week, Trump signed an executive order to withhold federal research and education grants from hospitals that offer gender-affirming care to transgender youth. Major hospitals across the United States then announced they'll stop providing such treatments. Others, such as the New York City Hospital Network, NYU Langone, tried to quietly cancel appointments. But on Monday, as the White House released a statement claiming the order was, quote, already having its intended effect, New York Attorney General Letitia James responded by warning hospitals they will be in violation of New York State anti-discrimination laws if they stop offering this care. This comes as the American Civil Liberties Union, Lambda Legal, and others filed a lawsuit Tuesday on behalf of transgender youth who say the order is depriving them of medical care, quote, solely on the basis of their sex and transgender status, unquote. In a minute, we'll speak with the ACLU attorney Chase Strangio and with a doctor who says he was willing to go to jail to continue to provide transgender health care. But first, on Monday, here in New York, trans youth and their families were joined by elected officials, medical professionals, NYU workers, and trans activists at a rally to demand the NYU Langone Hospital Network ensure gender-affirming care for trans patients. These are some of their voices.
I'm Lorelai Crean. I'm a trans kid, and it's amazing to be surrounded by people who are fighting for my rights, even if it's I have been stripped of my rights again, with NYU Langone denying access to life-saving, gender-affirming care to trans kids like me. I came here straight from school, and when I walked into first period, which was algebra, everyone asked why I had a megaphone with me, which I'm not even using because I'm using a mic now. I told them that I was coming to the protest because NYU Langone had stopped providing gender-affirming care to minors. My friend hadn't heard the news yet, and she started freaking out, telling me that she had an appointment there scheduled for a month from now, and asking me if that would still happen. I told them that I don't know, but we're here today demanding that it will.
Yes! I'm Cynthia Nixon, and I'm here as a lifelong New Yorker. Yes. And I'm here as a person who loves my city and my state. And I am here as actually a resident of Kips Bay. I live just a few blocks over there. And NYU is my hospital. Most importantly, I am here today as the mother of a proud trans man. I am here today as the aunt of a proud trans man. My best friend's kid is trans, and my kid's best friend is trans. My wife and I, our lives are filled with the most amazing, beautiful, brave trans people, young and old, but especially young. My trans kid had his top surgery at NYU a number of years ago. His doctors were fantastic. His surgeon was the best we could have imagined. And the idea
that this city is filled with young people who thought they had a place to go where they could receive the highest care, and that place has now been shut to them, sickens me to my core.
My name is Freya. I am 16 years old. I have been on estrogen since I was 14, and I know that I'm very privileged to be able to say that. But in the same breath, I can say that I am scared for myself, for my own health care, and for all of the other people like me. And I have one message to my kinfolk, because that's what we are. All the people who are here and are like me and are showing up willing to fight for our own rights or the rights of the people that we love and care about, don't let them win.
Some of the voices at the rally Monday calling on the NYU Langone Hospital Network to continue to restore gender-affirming care to transgender youth after canceling appointments for transgender children following Trump's executive order. Thanks to NYC DSA for the video. For more, we're joined by two guests. Dr. Jeffrey Birnbaum is with us. He's a pediatrician, adolescent medicine specialist who works with transgender youth in New York City. And here in our studio, Chase Strangio, co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. We welcome you both. Chase, let's begin with you. You were the first trans attorney to argue before the Supreme Court. We're waiting for that decision to come out. But you just filed a lawsuit. Explain what it is.
Yeah, so thank you, Amy. We are obviously living in a situation that is catastrophic for transgender people of all ages, particularly transgender youth, with actions from the Trump administration almost every day targeting our community that represents less than 1% of the population. And one of those orders sought to, in essence, threaten and coerce hospitals across the country to shut down care, including in places like New York and California and Illinois and Virginia, where people thought they were safe from the state-level bans that have been passing for the last several years. And what we're seeing now is that there is a lot of compliance in advance with this executive order, as the rally in New York made very clear. However, we also have to know that it is the Trump administration that is holding our entire medical system in the United States hostage to threaten people, to punish transgender people for simply existing. And it is not just transgender youth. This is an order that goes up to 19 years old. I have been on the phone with people who deliberately waited through their entire adolescence until they were 18 years old so that they could access medical care. And then they had those appointments canceled on the way to the hospital, on the week of those appointments. The devastation is staggering, and we are in federal court to make it clear that, first, the president does not have the authority to override Congress and decide how money that has been allocated by Congress, as the Constitution makes clear, can be taken away just because the president doesn't like how it's being used. And second, this action violates the individual constitutional rights of transgender adolescents and their families, as well as transgender 18-year-olds.
And Chase, as you mentioned, the transgender population of the country is around less than 1%. Why do you think that the Trump administration has focused so much attention on repressing and discriminating against the trans community?
I think the Trump administration is doing it for two reasons. And the first reason is that the Trump administration, as the campaign spending made clear, thinks that transgender people are an easy target for him to engage in this type of power grab where he exceeds his authority as president, thinks it's going to be legitimized, and then he can use that excess of authority to start targeting all sorts of other communities that do have political power. But he seeks to have a precedent in what he believes to be a vulnerable and unsupported community. So we need to see people standing up. And the second reason is that transgender people pose a threat to the reinforcement of the sex binary, which is a centerpiece of this administration. This is about deciding and enforcing government-mandated roles about how men and women can live in this country. And this is a full takeover for all of us that we should be very concerned about. It is part of the authoritarian move of this administration, in exactly like we see from leaders like Orban, Bolsonaro, and others who use control over the body, the gender binary, and the family to build their authoritarian power.
I want to bring Dr. Jeffrey Birnbaum into this conversation, a pediatrician, adolescent medicine specialist who works with transgender youth. Can you talk about what's happening in these hospitals? I've heard stories of one person after another, as Chase just said, about to go in for surgery, having all the medical preparation, and then being told it's canceled. You say you're willing to go to jail to continue to provide medical care for your patients?
Yes. You know, since I was quoted as saying that in the paper the other day, and I stand by my words, I've learned that there's more risk that comes to hospitals, at this point in time at least, than providers in terms of having their funding cut off and having their grants and so on turned off, and just having the flow of money into their institutions turned off, more so than providers. But I stand by my words. Since the NYU news came out and people have been turned away, we've actually gotten phone calls in my clinic of people who were just desperate to be able to come into care. And so we've accepted some of the people who have been turned away by NYU. I hope at some point they come to their senses and reverse their stance. My hospital, and I'm speaking my own views, I'm not necessarily speaking theirs, but they've been very supportive of me to continue to be able to do my work. But they've asked me to ensure that I make it clear that I'm speaking my views and not theirs for some very obvious reasons.
And Dr. Birnbaum, your thoughts on an executive order that declares that there are just two sexes, male and female, the impact that this has on the population, especially the transgender population?
I mean, that's a highly ill-informed and uninformed position for them to take. You know, we're talking about biology, not politics. And some of these folks, if they wanted to go into science, they should become scientists and stay out of and keep politics out of science. We have tons and tons of medical literature that backs up the practice that we're doing through the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, the Endocrine Society. You look at the references that they follow. Of course, there's more research that needs to be done. We're doing something that is scientifically based, and they're just making this up. If they want to accuse us of espousing gender ideology, well, we're following science, and they're the ones that are really espousing gender ideology.
Dr. Birnbaum, you have been getting texts nonstop and calls from your patients. What does it mean to interrupt transgender care?
Yeah, they are terrified that their care is going to be interrupted. Many of the young people that I take care of prior to coming into care were suicidal, actually referred to us by psychiatric units for ongoing care after they were hospitalized for a suicidal event. And they fear going back to that state where they did not have access to gender-affirming hormonal therapy. And so I've had to make reassurances. I've stated to them what I was quoted in the paper saying, I will go to jail to defend your care. Your care is not stopping. This is a safe space where you access your care, and it's going to remain that way. I anticipate that if the executive order were to go through, there will be deaths involved. One of the quotes from the young people at the protest the other day saying this was life-saving care, and I ascribe to that notion that it is life-saving, it is certainly life-affirming care, and to take that care away from them will definitely increase levels of dysphoria in young people, and many of them will go on to commit suicide or at least think about it.
Well, I want to end with Chase Strangio. How does this relate to the Supreme Court case and what will happen with the decision that will be handed down? And also, the state attorney general, Letitia James, weighing in.
Yeah, so we are at the Supreme Court right now arguing that this very type of attack on medical care for transgender people violates the Constitution. Now, we are up against state officials and now federal officials that are trying to undo equal protection protections for the entire population. So this is going to be a major test at the Supreme Court this term. It will have impacts for these executive orders and whether or not they're constitutional. But even putting Scrimeti aside, which is the case at the Supreme Court, this exceeds the president's authority. There are very clear constitutional limits on what the executive branch can do, what the legislative branch can do, and what the judicial branch can do. And we see the president far exceeding his authority. And thankfully, there are attorney generals across the country that are stepping in, suing the administration, reminding entities in New York State that they have to continue to follow state law. But there are people who have fled their homes in places like Tennessee and Florida to relocate to places like New York and Massachusetts, only to have that care shut off. There, this is a crisis, and people need to be responding accordingly.
And Letitia James?
You know, I'm glad to see her stepping in and threatening hospitals because they do have to follow New York law. And at the same time, the Trump administration is threatening federal funding, which preempts state law. So we are in a situation where, yes, we need to fight back and remind people to follow the state laws, but we need to aim our focus at the Trump administration and the fact that they are coercing entities to shut off care to transgender people.
Chase Strangio, co-director of the ACLU's LGBTQ and HIV Project, argued before the Supreme Court in December. Dr. Jeffrey Birnbaum, pediatrician, adolescent medicine special who works with transgender youth. Next up, we speak with a former top lawyer at the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She was just fired as part of Trump's purge of federal workers. Back in 20 seconds. Let Me In by De La Soul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the former top lawyer at the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She was fired last week as part of the Trump administration's purge of federal workers and broad attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in the workplace. In a press release from the new EEOC leadership, titled, quote, Removing Gender Ideology and Restoring the EEOC's Role of Protecting Women in the Workplace, the acting EEOC chair, Andrea Lucas, says she'll prioritize compliance and litigation to, quote, defend the biological and binary reality of sex and related rights, including women's rights to single-sex spaces at work, unquote. For more, we're joined by Carla Gilbride. She is now the former general counsel of the EEOC after she and two EEOC commissioners were fired last week in the late night purge. In 2022, Gilbride became the first blind lawyer to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court. She's now the new deputy director of Public Citizen Litigation Group. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why were you fired? Talk about you and the commissioners. Is this even legal?
Hi, Amy. It's great to be here. So I was fired last week as general counsel of the EEOC. That's the position that heads the litigation program. As you mentioned, two of the four commissioners, two who were appointed by President Biden, were also fired, and that is unprecedented. There have never been commissioners fired before the end of their term, and this is not the only agency where Trump has done this in recent weeks. And the EEOC was established as part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act to ensure equal opportunity in the workplace based on make sure people are not discriminated on, based on race, based on sex, based on disability, age, or national origin, or religion. And I am concerned that President Trump removing commissioners will imperil that mission. I'm also concerned, based on the press release that you just read, that, you know, one of the parts of the EEOC's mission and the litigation program that I worked on as general counsel involved enforcing the 2020 Supreme Court decision in Bostock versus Clayton County, which recognized discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity as forms of sex discrimination. And the binary of sex that doesn't recognize, you know, that people, the reality, the lived reality and the medical reality, that people have gender identities that do not match their sex assigned at birth, and that if someone is discriminated against because they're transgender, because they're non-binary, or certainly because of their sexual orientation, which is not mentioned in that press release, those are protected traits under Supreme Court precedent and under Title VII, and the EEOC needs to be able to vigorously enforce that law as passed by Congress and as enforced by the Supreme Court.
And Carla Gilbert, I'm wondering, you mentioned that this this kind of sledgehammer approach is not just at the EEOC, but throughout the federal government in the last few weeks. It reminds me that Mussolini, the founder of modern fascism, declared that fascism was, in essence, he called it corporatism, a merger of state and corporate power. And we're seeing this merger occurring right here now as more and more billionaires and business people are taking over the functions of government. I'm wondering your sense of what this means to the view of the state as a sort of a mediator of the conflicts within society, now to have this government so rapidly taken over by business people.
I am concerned about not only the many actions that the president has taken to exceed his powers under the Constitution, but also the influence of private, unelected representatives of corporations like Elon Musk, most notably through his role with this shadowy Department of Government Efficiency, which is involved in lots of different agencies. In my new role after leaving the EEOC, I've moved on to Public Citizen, which recently filed suit against the Treasury Department because at the orders of the Department of Government Efficiency, lots of private information of federal workers, of retirees, of anyone who does business and has financial information stored with the Treasury Department is now in the hands and has access has been given over to unknown and unaccountable, you know, individuals who are affiliated with Elon Musk, who are affiliated with DOGE, which is not a government department, and the individuals, you know, working with Mr. Musk have not gone through the vetting that individuals would normally have to go through in order to have access to that sensitive private information. And so Public Citizen filed suit to seek an injunction, to seek a stop to this turnover of private information, which there are should be government safeguards to protect. But in this unprecedented sort of mixture of private and public authority through involving oligarchs at the highest levels of our government who are unelected, that needs to be stopped. And we hope that the courts will step in to put an end to this unprecedented mixture of private and public power and abuse of executive authority.
Carla Gilbride, before we end, can you describe what happened last week when you and two EEOC commissioners were fired? What happened? What time was it?
So I received the email at around 10:30 p.m. telling me that, you know, again, citing this sort of unbounded authority that the president has to have people that agree with him ideologically serving in his administration, that my services were no longer required. And the email also referred to, again, this concept of gender ideology, this idea that the president wanted to be able to enforce the sex binary, even though, as I mentioned, that's contrary to Supreme Court precedent. And there was also a reference in the email to diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, has just become sort of a boogeyman and a concept that is being used to tar all sorts of efforts, including the efforts of the EEOC to enforce the civil rights laws, which is what I was doing as general counsel, was overseeing litigation to enforce civil rights laws that have been on the books for, 30, in some cases, 60 years.
Carla,